Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, what difference can a day make? For half of the world's population who struggle with social, economic, and political inequity, a day honoring women may be only symbolic, but could be life-changing. Seattle's most recent International Women's Day celebration, Be Bold for Change, took place at Town Hall Seattle on March 8th. Martha Adams, the producer of the documentary Girl Rising, a film that explores how it is that 130 million girls around the world are denied access to education and how to change that fact, gave the keynote speech. She was joined by a powerful group of Seattle area women who shared personal and historical perspectives and hopes for the future. Here, Martha Adams begins her talk on her experience creating Girl Rising.
So for Girl Rising, some of you have seen the film. We were asked to make a film about this powerful truth that when you educate girls, entire communities benefit. It seems obvious, right? But it wasn't at the time. That when you educate girls, crop yields go up, infant mortality goes down, literacy goes up. National security improves. Everyone benefits when you educate girls. And yet, there's 130 million girls missing from classrooms today. The good news is we have a solution. It's about education. So I went around the world and interviewed lots and lots of girls. And I'm going to play just one chapter from the film. You're going to hear Suma's story, and then afterwards I'll come up on stage and share what's happened since the film came out.
I write songs to remind myself that my memories are real. And often, because there's so much sadness behind me, what comes out is sad. Both of my parents were bonded as Kamlar and Kamlari in their childhood. That's the way things have been around here. That's the way they have been for the poor. You have to bond yourself to a master, otherwise, how will you live? This was the house of my first master. My mother and father bonded me just so that I would have somewhere to live and enough food to eat. I was 6 years old. Faguthuru was a landlord and a miller. He made me work from 4 a.m. to late at night. I had to clean the house and wash the dishes and go to the forest to fetch firewood. When I wasn't minding the goats, I had to mind the children. The goats were nicer. The daughters made fun of me because my clothes were torn. They teased me. They beat me. I wanted my mother and father to take me back. I wanted them to let me stay at home and go to school like my brother. But when I thought about how poor they were and how much they too had suffered, it made me feel weak. I couldn't ask. This was the house of my second master. Janakmala wore a uniform to work. He and the mistress of the house were very hard-hearted. Unlucky girl, they used to call me. Hey, unlucky girl, do this, they'd shout. They made me sleep in the goat shed and wear rags and eat scraps from their dirty plates. I can't really talk about everything that happened to me here, but I will never forget. This is where I began to write songs. Only the songs got me through.
Dadu bhaiya ni school ma parna mai dukhi chai jindar va ghar jaina mara khaina kasin mari jiba.
This was the house of my third master. I was 11 years old when I arrived at Chitai Tharu's house. I had been a Kamlari for 5 years. It wasn't as bad here. I mean, it was bad because there was a lot of work. But there was a lodger in that house, a school teacher called Bimal Sir. He changed my life. Bimal Sir convinced my master and mistress to enroll me in a night class. All of us would gather after finishing our day's work, and we would learn to read and write. I loved that night class so much. It was run by social workers for girls just like me, Kamlaris. We would also talk to the teachers about what it was like to be a Kamlari. And as we talked, we began to realize that bonded labor was, and isn't it, slavery. The teachers who ran the night class began to go from house to house. They wanted to liberate us. One teacher, Sita Didi, told my master that he was breaking the law by keeping me as a Kamlari. She talked about the law against bonded labor, and the law about children's rights, and the law on labor rights, and the law against domestic violence and trafficking. She talked to him about justice and injustice, and she demanded that he set me free. My master said no. Once made, a bond couldn't be broken. Sita Didi didn't give up. She kept arguing. She came back day after day. And in the end, she led me home to my mother and father. I am my own master now. I have no mistress. I was the last bonded worker in my family. After me, everyone will be free. I feel as though I have power. I feel like I can do anything. And I have important things to do. Inside this house is a girl like I was. Away from her parents, working morning to night, wanting so badly to be free. We have come to this house, the house of her master, to say, we know you have a Kamlari working for you. You must set her free.
Unko aankha ma phulai sansara karako aankha ma karai sansara.
I've seen where change comes from. When it comes, it's like a song you can't hold back. Suddenly, there's a breath moving through you, and you're singing. And others pick up the tune and start singing, too. And a sweet melody goes out into the world and touches the heart of one person, then another, and another.
So, Suma, I just want to take a moment and have us wrap our head around her life story for a moment. So she was 6 when she was sold, and then she was reunited with her family at the age of 12. So that's kindergarten through 6th grade. When she was reunited with her mother and her father, she could no longer speak her native language. She could no longer make eye contact. She was a broken individual. But as you saw in the film, she was paired with an organization called Room to Read. Yes, an awesome organization. And they have a social mobilizer program, and that's the woman that you saw in the film. Today, Suma is leading the charge to end indentured servitude. You will frequently see her on the front pages of the newspaper. And not that long ago, she was invited to perform that song at Lincoln Center to a packed audience. I'm about to show you. Let's see. Here she is, backstage at Lincoln Center. She's in excellent company, excellent company. So I said to her in New York, I said, Suma, isn't this amazing? Can you believe this? Can you believe this has happened? And she didn't quite catch what I meant. So I said, Suma, how old was your mother when she married? She said, 14. How old do you want to be when you get married? She says, I don't know, 27, 29, I don't know. How many kids did your mother have? 12. How many kids do you want to have? 2 would be nice. Does your mom read? Does she write? No. Can you read? Can you write? Of course I can. What did your mom dream of? And she paused and she said, nothing. I said, well, what do you dream of? And she says, I want to become a pharmacist. I want to open the first pharmacy in my region of Nepal. That's a nod to public health. And I said, well, isn't this incredible? So how do you explain this change in such a short period of time? And she paused and she looked up and she said, the change is me. I am the change. So I thought that was absolutely extraordinary, except that it wasn't. Because in making Girl Rising and now doing the work that I'm doing with countless other people, we now know that there are hundreds, thousands of girls across the developing world right now taking courageous steps to carve a new path for their community. I mean, this is, you want to talk about bold? This is bold. So we thought after the film came out that our work was done. Educate girls, change the world, right? But we made a second discovery. What we realized, and you're going to think it's obvious, but at the time, you know, when you're in the thick of it, it's just not, that a girl can want to go to school all she wants, but unless the people in her community, unless her mother, her father, the teacher, the principal, the religious leader, unless they say she can go, she's not going to go. So at Girl Rising, we said, well, we know that there are countless nonprofits around the world who are doing the physical work of getting girls into school. They're giving bikes and scholarships, and they're building separate bathrooms at the school. This is all necessary work. But we decided that at Girl Rising, we would focus on changing the way people think about girls. That we would try to change mindsets and actually raise the value of a girl. Our hope is basically to ask the world to dream as big for your daughters as you do for your sons. So the original film, we received funding and we started adapting the film and launching campaigns around the world. So we launched 2 weeks ago in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This photo is from that. We launched in northern Nigeria. You know something about that part of the world. And we also launched in India. And we are in movie theaters now, and we've blanketed the media distribution pipeline, but we also have grassroots programs. And so now I would like to share with you three examples that I've witnessed or that have had a profound impact on me where I've witnessed someone being bold for change. This is in Rajasthan, India. In 2000, and as recent as 2002, what percentage of girls graduated from secondary school? Just take a guess. 2002, Rajasthan, India. That's not that long ago. The answer is zero. Zero. I kept saying, this can't be right, this can't be right. That's just not that long ago. Zero. Through a program with World Vision and IBTADA, they brought Girl Rising to Rajasthan, and we started to dig in and do work, community engagement work. And I took this photo. We were meeting with the religious leaders in this village, and they were explaining to me that after the program, they were open to the change. They wanted to know how their daughters were safely going to get to school. They wanted to make sure that there were going to be female teachers because they weren't comfortable with their daughters being taught by men. Really good questions and really important concerns. And at the end of this program, they agreed to let girls go to school. In Rajasthan, in the same community, they started a Girl Rising brother-sister program. This young boy is wearing a pin, the green ribbon, and he took an oath. And to be in this club, he has to do a few things. He has to make sure that his sister gets safely to school. He has to teach her how to ride a bike. Because in Rajasthan, traditionally, girls have never been allowed to ride a bike, play outside, or swing on a swing. He also has to do chores with her at the end of the school day so she has time to do her homework. More and more, we're finding that parents, if you say, "Will you send your daughter to school?" they'll say, "Yeah, okay, let's do this." And then you say, "Well, just a couple other questions. Who has to do all the chores?" "Well, my daughter." "Who gets the protein? How's the food divvied up?" And this is what when you peel back the layers of gender discrimination, these are the kinds of things you have to take a close look at. This is in Rajasthan. This is the very first co-ed cricket match. It's actually the first sports team for girls. This principal, he said, "You know, for years after lunch, the girls have always had to do the dishes. And now I'm going to ask the boys to do the dishes." This is the last picture from the Rajasthan community, and this is two best friends. The girl on the right, her mother, her father passed away, and she just could not allow her daughter to go to school because there was too much work at home. So the community partnered her with this other girl who said that she would go home after school and share the work in the fields so that they would both have time so that the other girl would have time to do her homework. So this is what community-led change looks like. And this is change that's happening right now. I mean, this is radical, transformational change. And I just wonder, you know, a lot of times we don't hear about this. The next example is a really tough one. I've never actually publicly... It's so tough that it's like I'm not going to go up there. Well, I will just start talking about it. So in 2016, a girl named Sumera was in Pakistan, and her brother suspected that she was using her cell phone to talk to a boy. So he thought he did the right thing. He grabbed a kitchen knife, and he stabbed her over and over. And then he dragged her body out the door and dumped it on the front stoop. And then he sat next to her, and looking at her cell phone, going through her call log. Neighbors gathered around as she bled to death, and the police arrived. I know you've all heard about honor killings, but something incredible happened in that moment when the police arrived. They did something that nobody in that region that knows police work did. Instead of writing down the names of the family members who witnessed the crime, they wrote down individuals in the street. Now, why did they do that? Because family members traditionally could forgive for a crime like that. So the case would never make it to court. Those police officers in asking people who were not related to that girl to record that name, allowed that case to go forward. Now, how did that happen when we're talking about somebody like, we wrote on those white cards, right? We wrote what we're gonna do that's bold. But why did those policemen do that? Because, now I don't know, I didn't go there. I didn't witness this, thank God. But a woman named Charmaine, maybe you've saw her documentary, she made A Girl in the River. It won the Oscar last year. Prime Minister Sharif saw the film and decided to screen it for the Congress of Pakistan. And then he vowed to change the laws. And those police took a nod from their prime minister and decided to open it up. And that's how they did it differently. In October of last year, Pakistan passed a law forbidding honor killings. This is her brother. Let's see. Oh, my clicker's not working. Okay, this is the filmmaker, and this is Prime Minister Sharif. My third example, this one's a little bit easier to take. You might recognize the Meryl in the middle. I had the opportunity, I met with the First Lady a year or so ago, and we've been handling her 62 million campaign and doing some of the marketing for Let Girls Learn, and we talked about going on a trip together to really meet revolutionary girls, to hear in their own words, what's it like out there? What's it like carving this new path? What is it required? And so we headed off to Africa, and Meryl said she wanted to come. And so in this situation, we were interviewing the girl in the purple. That's Hanan. Now, Hanan lives in a very small all-Muslim village on the outskirts of Marrakesh. This is traditionally a place where girls have not gone to school. But Hanan is in this program. It's called Project SOAR, and it's funded in part by the Peace Corps. And at this small after-school program, girls go and they learn about empowerment and destiny and what to do when you get your period and just everything that nobody has ever bothered to talk to them about. So Meryl and I were wondering, now, Hanan, why in this place where girls traditionally have never been allowed to go to a place like this, how did Hanan get allowed to go? So we went home with her. Let's see if I can get this there. I hope you can see. That is Hanan with her mother and her father. Before we could talk to the mother and father, the imams from the mosque came. Meryl was rather nervous in that part of the day. We sat down and we had this amazing conversation with the religious leaders, and they welcomed us. Then we sat down with her father, and we said, we know you have lots of other children, and Hanan is your youngest. We know that the others are not educated. Why are you deciding to educate Hanan? And he said, because I've heard about the power of education. We are stuck in a cycle of poverty. This was his exact words. And I want to try something different. I want Hanan to become educated. So we spent the whole evening. It was Ramadan, and we made this feast, and we all sat down together. And over the course of the evening, we really had a chance to talk to the father about his life and the grandmother and the mom. And we realized that this, again, was radical change all coming down on Hanan. It was a very beautiful night, and this is me with Hanan's grandmother, and we were standing here, and we were wrapping up the evening, and I noticed behind me was a doorway, and there was fabric as a door, making so you couldn't go in and out. And I said, "Oh, Hanan, you didn't show me this room. What's in there?" She said, "Oh, that's where I sleep." I said, "Oh, can I see? Can you show me your books? Can I see where you keep your things?" And she said, "No." I said, "Oh, Hanan, please. I'm a photographer, so I love photographing desks and personal things." And she went to her dad, and she whispered in her dad's ear. And he said through a translator, he's like, "I'm sorry, but my 16-year-old daughter is in that room, and she is forbidden to come out. She is forbidden. She may not be seen by a Westerner." The entire time that we were in this house paying tribute to this father, there was Hanan's older sister hearing this entire conversation. And the reason why she couldn't come out is because she had already been arranged into marriage, and she married a very conservative man who said that she may not be seen. And that was, you know, that was a tough day, because on one hand, we were celebrating Hanan's life and the fact that she gets to now pursue her dreams. And yet, in the wake of that, there's so much suffering. In the end, I think when we're reflecting back on what it means to be bold, I think it really comes, for me at least, I think that, one, we have to have our eyes wide open. We have to be really present so that when we see somebody do something extraordinary, it might be really small, but we let them know. The second thing is about being bold is recognizing community and community-led change, that our actions are the sum of many, many, many events and people and role models that help support us along the way. And then the third thing, I think, is that, and I'm not entirely sure how to put this into words, but that we have to realize that sometimes somebody does something bold and beautiful in the midst of tragedy. And sometimes in that moment when Sumaira was killed by her brother, and we're reading about honor killings in the paper, and we feel dismay, and we just can't imagine how we're gonna sort out the problems of this world, that we have to focus and find the good news, because I'm telling you, it's there. So, if we do act in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is in itself a marvelous victory.
This evening, we are honored to have a superb panel of highly successful women who are making a difference in the wide range of work that they do. They champion human rights and are representatives of NGOs, education, health, and media organizations in Seattle. I'm going to ask them to share their stories with us tonight and tell us how they take action and take a stand. So please help me in welcoming the panelists. Kathy, please introduce yourself and tell us the things that you do to make yourself be bold.
Hello, everyone. I do want to give a special shout out to the Why We girls who are here. Why We is a program for young women empowered that is about creating opportunities for the next generation of leaders who are going to make the future better for all of us. So I just wanted to say thank you to those girls for coming. A little bit about me. I am the head of human resources at PATH. I serve on our executive team. So what is PATH? PATH is a global NGO, one of the largest. Our focus is on innovation in the areas of health equity. Our goal is health equity for all, but we focus on doing that through focusing on women and girls, and we do it through technology innovation in the arenas of vaccines, drugs, diagnostics, devices, and social service innovations. We operate in over 70 countries, and in many of those countries, which are largely located in Africa and Southeast Asia, International Women's Day is a holiday. So when I was asked to serve on this panel, I had to say yes, because I've seen the momentum and the energy and the celebrations that happen in some of the countries where PATH operates, and I thought, we should have that here, especially now. So I'm just thrilled to be part of this. I think you asked me a question, so maybe I'll move to the question. I have some notes.
What are the things that you do to make yourself be bold?
Thank you. I did just get off a plane from India yesterday. I'm a little jet lagged. So I did make some notes. And I'd say it starts with being clear about my values. If you were to look at my LinkedIn page, you would see that I say, know what you stand for and stand for it. So the key for me has been to do that work within myself to understand what I do stand for, and I'm clear on that. I stand for love. That's who I am. That's my purpose in life. So when I'm faced with a choice or an opportunity, I think about it from that context. Consequently, I think other people may see me as making bold choices that for me are really just natural choices. And I'll give you three examples of that. One was, I had a 20-year career at Microsoft. It was a very comfortable place for me. And then I joined PATH, a mission in health equity, something that aligns with my passion, focus on women and girls, a huge change, a move into a scientific arena that I knew nothing about, a risk. But for me, it was about wanting to be part of that mission. The second one was becoming the legal guardian for my stepchildren. And again, this was just a choice that was obvious to me from my value of love. And the third example I would give is leveraging my job. So I have the privilege of working in HR leadership. And my role is about focus, gives me the opportunity to focus on many of the issues that are in the news all the time, like pay equity, like creating opportunities for developing all people, but especially women, for leadership roles. And I take that very seriously and have been a champion and an advocate for women throughout my career in that way as part of my day job. So I'm lucky that I get to do that. But what else helps me be bold? So there's the clarity of my mission. There's also little things that I do. Strength training, yes, I lift weights. And I think this is very important. I love that you're working in exercise science because it's so important for confidence and strength for me to do that. And whatever that fitness goal that anyone has, that focus on our taking care of ourselves, strength helps us be strong in everything else we do and for our families. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention is investing in relationships. I made a commitment to a group of 7 women 20 years ago. We meet monthly for dinner. We share our lives, the good, the bad, the ugly. We're there for each other. We support each other. We give each other feedback. And we share joys and sorrows. And that has been a huge rock for me. And I would encourage you, if you don't have a circle like that, to go create one. And now I'm in the process of expanding my circle and really seeking to deepen relationships with women who are outside of my circle. I want to understand the experiences of my African American friends and other women of color and what those experiences are. What's that transgender challenge? So being engaged with a variety of people, building relationships, and listening to understand and learn is part of what I'm trying to be bolder about.
Thank you very much. Now, Marty, please introduce yourself and tell us about when and where you're planning to be bold next, and if there's a specific event or moment that you're planning will take some courage.
Alrighty. My name's Marty Hurtman. I'm the director of Mary's Place. I have an incredible job. Thank you. Amazing job. We are able to provide emergency shelter and resource centers for families and women experiencing homelessness. I've been with the organization since it started in 1999, and as you know, there's been an incredible change and shift in the number of people that are homeless. I have always believed that this is solvable, it is doable, and that we can bring every woman and family inside, but it will be our community that will do this. Over the last year, we were blessed with some corporate support that believes like we do, that no child should sleep outside in this community. And yeah, amazing. So led by Starbucks, Amazon, Microsoft, and 47 other corporations, they jumped in and ran toward this crisis. They said that this is solvable. We believe, like you do, that no child should sleep outside. And together we raised $4.5 million. Mm-hmm. Amazing. An incredible gift. And a life-saving gift. So my question that you proposed to me was, what is my bold next move? And my bold next move now is to deliver on that promise that no child would sleep outside. So we're working on it. So this year, we will double our capacity from 400 to 800 beds. We will take these vacant buildings that are slated for redevelopment and move families in and call them home for now. But that will give these families that brief moment in time, that one season they need to move forward. They will be able to stay together. We won't split this family up. They will stay together. They will be warm. They will be safe. They will be alive. And we will help them find a forever home. But it will be our community that will continue to work on this together. They are courageous. It's all of you coming together to remind these families that they're good, that they're worthy, that they're lovable, and that they will have a home.
Thank you for your incredible work. Karen, please introduce yourself and tell us about a time that you wish you would have been bold and weren't.
Thank you. I'm Karen Mathis. I'm president of Puget Sound Public Radio and general manager. General manager of KUOW 94.9, and I want to see that same level of enthusiasm for the fundraiser tomorrow. KUOW is 65 years old this year. That's even by public radio standards, that's quite a milestone. We were formulated in 1952, and we currently are serving upwards of 1 million people monthly on air, online, and digitally delivered fact-based journalism and stories of the Puget Sound. I've had Thank you. I've had a 49-year and counting career in journalism. No, I didn't start when I was five. I started when I was 13. Got my first story published in the local daily paper in southern Indiana when I was 13 in junior high school. But I've had a career in print, radio and TV, commercial and non-commercial. And I guess what drives me is that I do believe, and I am unapologetic about being evangelical about this, I do believe that freedom of information and fact-based journalism is a cornerstone of democracy. And I honestly do believe in Thomas Jefferson's words that a well-informed population is necessary for them to be trusted with their own governance. And so that's an important factor. I guess I cringe at the lack of boldness early in my career and my tenure as a manager when those accusations of being shrill were ringing inside your head. I think you all know what I'm talking about. And worrying about, oh, am I coming off as a shrill woman or too demanding or whatever, caused me to self-edit my speech, my presentation, my demeanor, probably more than I should have. I remember very early in my tenure as a GM, I had fought my way into the owner. It was a university owner in Michigan, and I fought my way into an architect's meeting at the university because I got wind of the fact that they were planning new space for the radio station without consulting us at all about what kind of space that we needed. And so I fought my way into that meeting, and I remember having the chief architect of the university. Now, mind you, there's a U-shaped table, and all the white male architects are on one side, and there's the little chocolate girl on the other side of the table. And the chief architect turned to his crew and said, "See, I told you she was going to be a problem." And so, and yet she persisted. But I think you have to remember, and this is sadly at any stage of your career, but particularly for women in the early stages of their career, when you'll feel outnumbered, outgunned, or you don't even have access to that kind of shadow layer of management that you're never quite able to get access to, and yet you know they're impacting your work life and your goals. There's this shadow layer that often is pulling a lot of the strings that you just can't get to, and that can be terribly intimidating. You can feel shut down and really unsure of how to proceed. Do I try to continue to be a fairly demure team player? Do I raise my voice and pound the table as some of my male colleagues do? How do I polish my powers of persuasion against players who don't view my presence there as equal or even valid? So I think what I learned is I'm old enough now that I don't care about being shrill. That's one thing. And I think just learning to parse those various skills, pull those skill sets out of the bag at the appropriate moments, that was a huge turning point for me as a leader. And I guess the last thought I'd like to leave you with for this portion, have you seen that television commercial for an antiperspirant? And the two women are in the elevator, and one woman has her hands in the air, and she's breathing hard, and she's getting her game face on, and the other woman is in her ear. Yes, those numbers are right. Yes, you studied the prospectus. Yes, you know what you're doing. You're killing it. You're killing it. Get out there. And I think that we have to be not only mentors, but cheerleaders, because the negative voices sometimes in our own head that society places there, and definitely the negative feedback that we often get from our surroundings, when we have a chance to, you know, be that cheerleader on that person's shoulder and say, "Get it, girl," we should do that.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Seattle's International Women's Day celebration, Be Bold for Change, took place at Town Hall Seattle on March 8th. You'll find the full version and many other great talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.